give forth that wonderful phrase to hear those three.
Ella Fitzgerald, what a wonderful way to welcome Patricia T. O'Connor to the show. Patricia is the author of a growing list of books, Woe Is I, and then Woe Is I Junior, aimed at the younger set. There's also Words Fail Me and You Send Me, and I'm sure there's another one also in the works, because the language is infinitely fascinating. Patricia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And I understand that today, before we start taking calls, and our number here is 212-433-9692, if you have something you want to talk about related to language and grammar, that you want to talk about instruction manuals.
Well, not for long, believe me, but I was reminded of how important good, clear, simple grammatical English is the other day when I was reading a piece in the Sunday Times about in August, 165 people in 31 states got salmonella poisoning. Many of them were seriously ill and had to be hospitalized because of bad cooking instructions on some banquet brand chicken and turkey pot pies.
Wow.
And after 2 months of blaming the consumers for misunderstanding the labels, ConAgra Foods, the parent company, only last week acknowledged that its directions were unclear and said it was recalling its pot pies and rewriting the instructions. Now, many consumers don't know what kind of microwave they have, whether it's high wattage, medium, low, ultra low. But this makes a big difference in the way cooking instructions are written, especially if the foods are raw. And a lot of people don't realize that the chicken and turkey in those pot pies starts out raw. It's not cooked and you're heating it up. It's raw.
So unless you put it on the right wattage,
exactly,
you might very well warm it up but not necessarily mm-hmm. really cook it and kill all the bacteria
exactly.
that will be or might be in that meat.
Right. You could end up killing yourself, in fact. Nobody died in this case, which was lucky. But my point is that I don't see why companies can't write simple, clear English on their packaging. We see it over and over again. It's a standard joke, the some assembly required item that you buy that ends up taking you all night to put together, if you ever do get it together.
Well, and in the case of ConAgra, they're an American company. There's no excuse. In other cases, often the instruction manuals are translated, and I got this mm-hmm. email from a listener who says, when I saw the main topic of Patricia's bit today, I thought of a website I used to visit, one of several worst manual contests. What I found was that it and several other sites that held such contests seemed to have stopped the event. That makes me worried. Have people just given up on having properly written manuals? And in defense of translators, my own experience on manuals as a translator is that I'm often given just the text of instructions totally out of context. I have no idea what the product is, and I'm not given the graphics, so I do a lot of improvisation and pity the poor soul who has to try to follow what I've written.
Mm-hmm. I think
I've read a couple of her manuals.
Yeah, well, I think what happened with the people who were running those sites is they all got salmonella poisoning, so we don't hear from them anymore. But I also got an email from a listener the other day that made me think of this ConAgra business. Because he sent me, this is a listener who listens on the web in Boise, Idaho. He's a former New Yorker, but he's a Leonard Lopate fan, and he listens on the web. And he sent me a copy of the owner's manual and a little operating tag that came with a steam iron that he and his wife bought at the Macy's in Boise, Idaho. And it had the worst run-on sentence I've ever I've seen a lot of them, but this really takes the cake, and I won't bother reading it to you, but it goes on and on and on, and it has absolutely zero punctuation. It mixes digits and written-out numbers.
Molly Bloom wrote it.
Maybe that's the explanation. This was a James Joyce admirer who wrote this instruction manual. But at any rate, I think we should all have a campaign. And next time we get bizarrely written instruction manuals, we should complain to the companies.
Well, there is a difference, I guess, if it's an American-based company, and Maytag is another one that is. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit more sympathetic if it's a foreign company, although I think that they should definitely have someone who really speaks English well check on it. Because, for example, setting up a videotape recorder or something like that, or a DVD player, and getting confused in the middle, where am I putting this wire? It can really be upsetting, and it can be dangerous, I think, in some cases.
Yeah, exactly.
So should we start taking some calls?
Yeah, although I did want to mention one other thing that listeners could be thinking about during the show. I got an email from Esther Navarez, who is the Community Relations Coordinator for the New Jersey Division on Civil Rights. And she asked me a question, and I asked her permission to pose it to listeners. And she says, same-sex couples who enter into a civil union, do they become civil unioned, civil unionized, civil united, civilly unioned, civilly unionized, civilly united, whatever. I work for the Division on Civil Rights, and I'm responsible for research, record maintenance, public hearings, queries, minutes, and agendas. I appreciate any advice on this. She would like a noun for referring to
civilians.
People. Maybe that's it. But anyway, perhaps listeners might have suggestions later in the show.
I think that it is an interesting problem, mm-hmm. because we've invented a new kind of marital arrangement, but it's not mm-hmm. marriage. We're trying to get around
right.
marriage. Some people are trying to get around marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've come up with this thing, and then they didn't think it all the way through.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the war in Iraq. we'll take some calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Hugh from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Are we having you?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, well, actually, if we're going to have you, we've insisted on making sure that we know the right microwave setting.
Okay. I've always been curious about the use of the word coupon for coupon. As far as I'm concerned, the spelling indicates that it should be pronounced as coupon, but I've always been upset that people pronounce it coupon, and I'm wondering if your expert has any comments on that.
Well, first of all, can I jump in on this? I say coupon, but I am pretty sure that if you look it up in your dictionary, and this eliminates an awful lot of pronunciation problems, you're going to find out that it says coupon first and coupon second.
Okay.
So as long as the dictionary says coupon, then that is an accepted pronunciation. In the same way that root and route, you know, I say route 66, but many people say they're out on route 11. I don't. am I right? Because the dictionary lists that as the first thing? No, they're just as right as I am.
Well, we don't pronounce cougar as cougar, so I don't understand the difference.
Oh, well, you're asking for consistency from the English language, Pat. You want to talk about that?
Well, actually, Leonard, you're right. The American Heritage Dictionary does have first listed pronunciation is coupon. The second is coupon. But I admit, I agree with the caller. I always think coupon sounds dippy.
Really?
I don't know why. But
but we all have those pronunciation prejudices.
We do.
And some of them, in some cases, our prejudices are against the correct pronunciation mm-hmm. because they sound pretentious. Mm-hmm. Banal, for
right.
example.
Uh-huh. Right. When my husband and I first got together, he was always shocked at a few of my pronunciations. For example, striped for the word that he pronounces striped.
Yeah.
Well, everyone in Iowa says striped.
You say striped bass?
Striped bass. Uh-huh.
Whoa.
And I say roof.
Yeah. And many people
and root beer.
And many people say height instead of height.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even though there's no TH there.
Right.
And
right.
that's simply because of the area that you come from.
Right. And I think maybe there's some parallelism with eighth.
Mm-hmm.
Or length.
Yeah, I think it's length and height.
Yeah,
the way people
yeah,
are thinking
yeah.
of it.
But you know, we live in a big country, and it wouldn't be the great country it is if we didn't have differences like that. And I think that regional differences are charming, myself.
Well, I believe that we should all speak the same way, and that I should be the arbiter.
Okay.
David, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I was wondering about the word integris.
Integris. I don't know if I've ever heard anyone use that word.
Neither have I. So when I came across it recently on a website, I was wondering about it. I looked it up in a few dictionaries, and I could not find it.
Well, maybe it's it's a word that someone just invented to make a point. How was it used? What context?
I don't remember the sentence, but the fragment of the sentence was integrous food. I guess it meant the food had integrity.
Or maybe it's food that's all mixed together, like integrated. Like stew.
I hadn't thought of that.
I don't know. I've never heard the word either, and I'm not finding it in the dictionary.
I Googled it, and it actually came up on a couple of other websites, so I think it might be one of these words that's kind of got coined somewhere and is starting to gain ground.
Next thing you know, it'll be as popular as interface.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
Thank you for calling. We've been warned, integris, the next word. And there are actually dictionaries that name a word of a year. Have you been following that, Pat?
Right. Is it Merriam-Webster? I know the American Dialect Society has a word of the year.
In 2 years, it's going to be integris.
Oh, Lord. Okay, I guess it will.
We go now to John. Hi, John.
Leonard?
Yes, you're calling from?
From Orangeburg.
From Orangeburg.
Yes.
Okay.
Just a little upstate.
A little north of New Jersey.
Yes. I'm excited to be on. I listen all the time.
And what do you want to talk about?
Well, I always hear, especially in the corporate atmosphere, we talk about different possibilities, and then people talk about, well, that's doable. And you wonder, is that really a word? Is that just an extension of a word?
Actually, you may be shocked to learn this, John, but doable has been around for hundreds of years.
Oh, no kidding.
No kidding. I don't know whether it was revived out of the blue because it just made sense, but it actually is a very old word. Doable, something that is capable of being accomplished.
So it's a true word.
It's a true word.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Do you think you're going to be able to sleep tonight because of that?
Well, I always thought about this, and it really bothered me, so thank you for clearing it up.
We thank you, and we go now. What is your name? I'm sorry. Is it Magenta?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, Magenta.
Magenta. Oh, gee. I think it was misspelled on my computer here. Magenta, what a colorful name.
Yes, well, for the moment it is. Hi, I just would love to have someone corroborate something that is driving me nuts, which is I notice over the last several years, especially in the last year and a half or so, when I listen to news reports, I mean, even NPR or guests on NPR, not so much you guys on WNYC, but the use of the correct, what I was taught was the correct use of prepositions seems to be getting very, very loose and sloppy and changing a lot. And, for instance, as soon as I called, I realized that to come up with an example, I'm never going to give one or as many as I hear all the time. But, for instance, somebody says, you have the ability of doing something rather than, you know, the ability to or. You just take it from there.
Right.
Everything. It just seems to be incredibly loose. And I'm just wondering whether you've noticed this, and I'm especially aware of it because in learning another language, for instance, in learning Italian, when you're speaking, it's extremely important to be understood clearly to learn the proper prepositions
that
go with the verb.
I got an email about that a couple of days ago. Well, not that particular example, but someone was saying that a friend had been translating something from Italian into English, and that the literal translation was, I am interested to do this.
Well, there are a lot of these kinds of things in Italian. But what I'm talking about is in English, we learned, at least I did, part of it by ear, part of it by, you know, rote, I suppose, to really assign certain prepositions
to certain verbs.
To function with certain verbs,
Yeah, you're right. And in fact, what I told that emailer was that usually with interest we use in. you have an interest in something rather than an interest to something.
But they're probably using the infinitive in Italian and just translating it.
Correct, correct. And if you're interested in this kind of thing, there is a book I can recommend that has a nice list of idiomatic prepositions. And it's the only book I've seen that has this. It's called Words Into Type. And it has a list of several pages of fine print verbs and the prepositions they usually take.
More often I'm seeing the word and use instead of the word to. For example, try and find it.
Yeah, that's an old idiomatic expression too. And that doesn't bother me so much. Try and do something.
But what does it mean?
Well, it means try to.
Try to do it.
Right.
Let's to do. That is an infinitive that really is necessary in that sentence.
Right. Yeah. You're right.
I'm not trying to be right, Pat. I'm just just trying to live the good life. And part of living the good life is taking a break right now. But we will be back with more of your calls to Patricia T. O'Connor, author of Woe Is I Junior, Words Fail Me, You Send Me. The list goes on and on and on. Back with Patricia T. O'Connor, who visits us once a month to talk about the weird language that we speak, a language that is incredibly rich but also can be rather difficult at times. The other day, Pat, I was talking with the two translators of War and Peace, this incredible new translation of War and Peace, and they were discussing the difficulties. But they said one of the interesting things is that both Russian and English are incredibly word-rich, and that makes them, in some cases, it makes it hard to translate from Russian to English because it's got so many of its own unique words. But English is better to translate into than practically any other language in the world because we have so many nuanced words to choose from.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine having four or five different translations of War and Peace into French to choose from? There would be hardly any reason to do that.
Because once you've figured it out, if you've done a decent translation, that's it.
Right. How many prepositions are there in French? Not nearly as many as we have in English. We were just talking about prepositions.
Well, there are a lot of propositions in France, but that's a whole other matter, isn't it?
If you get lucky, I suppose.
Let's go to Camille from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I love the show so much, and especially this segment that you all do.
And Camille, I'm not going to ask you if you're a member.
I'm not officially a member yet, and though you didn't really ask me, I'll answer. Well, I just wanted to follow up because Magenta, your last caller, wanted some corroboration. And my peeve is the Home and Garden Network, which I love, seems to have an obsession. Every host, it seems, has this new language, this new weird garden and renovation vernacular where they say, paint this out. Or if we use a contrasting color, we can frame this wall out, or we can change this old hardware out. And I guess maybe try to lengthen writing somehow, or
maybe they're outing themselves.
I think
that might be a good place to do it.
We see that happening a lot, I think, in these sort of do-it-yourself programs that become popular on television.
Yeah.
You see it in cooking programs too. They have to come up with new and different ways of saying all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, what do you say? Take an egg, put it in the bowl. You know, they have to have a little extra zing. So they talk about framing out and coloring this in and that sort of thing.
Do you feel it's going to be on the level of acceptability as the same as I wanted to see where you're at?
Well,
that
may be with us. That may be with us for a while. What I think isn't going to be with us for a while is what I heard one day on the Weather Channel, which was there was some bad weather coming, and the Weather Channel people said, exercise caution when driving to or from your destination. I think there can only be one proper
driving,
preposition
well,
for
unless
that.
You're driving in rear.
In circles.
Backward.
Yeah.
In reverse was the word I was trying to reach for. Thank you so much for your call. We have a listener in Seattle, by the way, who just called. And that's another thing that's so incredible about public radio these days. We can reach people all over the world. This listener says, first of all, I just love the show. I want to let you know that I searched Integris and found it on www.urbandictionary.com, defined as full of integrity. Or actually, this listener wrote integrity. Now, I don't know whether that was a point or I just think it probably means integris probably means full of integrity. Isn't that incredible?
Well, I could swear that I once heard a word integritas, meaning having integrity. I don't see it in the dictionary right now. But the word the other caller called in about was integris. Integris.
Yes. Well, there.
Now,
here's a listener who writes in, says, on Monday I bought a new HP notebook computer. After I unpacked it, I opened a fold-out set of instructions with graphics and four frames in 5 minutes, and I was up and running. It was a miracle.
Well, that's because he read the instruction manual before turning the thing on.
And HP probably had clear instructions.
They probably did.
There are people who do, but I am shocked by...
There are companies known for good instructions and companies known for really horrible ones.
I'm shocked by some of the language some of the writing that I see from people who've just gotten out of college. If anything, they have been destroyed by the college experience. they write in ways that obfuscate rather than ever clarify.
Mm-hmm. I've heard this complaint of new lawyers, new graduates of law school who are hired by big firms who end up spending lots and lots of money hiring consultants to come in to teach them how to write sentences that have, say, parallel construction, sentence-verb agreement, things like that, because they need to be able to do that in briefs. So they may have the Harvard law degree, but they don't necessarily... They still can't write. So there's a whole field now of consultants who go around to big law firms and give seminars to new law school graduates on how to write.
And they really should learn how to write because some of the most popular bestseller writers are lawyers.
Look at Alan Dershowitz. I mean...
I was thinking of a few of the writers of fiction.
John Grisham.
Yeah.
Right.
He's done very well. I don't know whether he ever wrote in that legalese, but he's kind of figured it out. Mm-hmm. We go now to a caller from Somerset, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, this is Dennis.
Yes, Dennis.
Before I get to my main point, I just wanted to give you another bad preposition example. I heard someone, I believe it was in PR, recently say something was beneath the pale.
It was a drip, actually.
My example has to do with the richness of the English language and how some things that sometimes sound illogical at first make perfect sense when you think about them. I'm not sure you follow college football, but this year there have been a number of upsets among the top-ranked teams. And I heard a sports guy the other day say six of the top five college teams have lost this year. Top five ranked college teams have lost this year. And at first you think about six of the top five doesn't make sense. But when you realize over time there have been a number of teams that have moved in and out of those rankings because of those upsets.
Right.
And it really is a perfectly logical sentence when you get right to the bottom of it.
Mm.
Well,
I can see that now, but it's it
yeah. But
weird.
I would have. I must admit, I would have thought, well, that guy used to be a jock. Thank you so much for calling us.
You're welcome. Bye.
That's that has to do with names of categories, and that's one of the problems with the spoken language, because if you'd read that, they would have probably put it in quotes, or there would have been capitals or something, mm-hmm. that would have indicated that they were talking about a category. But when you just hear it, it can be rather ambiguous. But that's also part of the fun of language, isn't it? It's the poetry
so.
Of language?
I think so. It also allows a lot of latitude for jokes. Mm-hmm. And puns.
Right. Puns don't work as well on the written page.
No. But...
And they don't work as well when I do them on the show either. People just groan.
I think they work very well. I like your puns a lot.
Ken from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I am a member. I'd like to blow the whistle let's see if I can get this out of my mouth, on a case of lexicographical airbrushing. I've got this old, I'll just use this Webster's here, which there's a long string of copyright dates, but the last one's 82. Mm-hmm. And the entry for capitalism, let me just read this. Number one, it's wild. The economic system in which all or most of the means of production and distribution, as in land, factories, etc., are privately owned and operated for profit, originally under fully competitive conditions. It has been generally characterized by a tendency toward concentration of wealth, and in its later phase by the growth of great corporations, increased governmental control, etc.
So wait, you said that was the Marx-Webster dictionary?
Merriam-Webster. Which is Gulf and Western Corporation, as a matter of fact, it says here. But that was 82. I've also got an American Heritage going back to 76 is the last in this long string. And it says, an economic system characterized by freedom of the market with increasing concentration of private and corporate ownership of production and distribution means proportionate to increasing accumulation and reinvestment of profits, you know, also number one. And
that's really poorly written, don't you think?
Well, but last night I went to, you know, the Barnes & Noble to see what the dictionaries say now, and you know, checked American Heritage and Webster's, and you know, the C word, concentration, gone.
Mm-hmm.
All reference to that, gone. You know, they just talk about private ownership at etc. And I just wonder when, you know, how I can go about finding out when the change occurred, because I think there's a story there.
Well, I think it's post fall of the Berlin Wall. And in fact, I was expecting you to say mm-hmm. the new definition is we won.
The good guys won. You know, those companies have websites where I think you can click on something and ask the editors a question if you want. So you might try that. There's a Merriam-Webster has a great website. I'm sure American Heritage does too. Uh-huh. And you can probably ask the editors that question.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for calling us.
No pleasure. Bye-bye.
Claire from... Oh, what happened, Claire? Let me see if I can get that.
I'm here.
Oh, hi. But I think we have a little conference call here. We have to do something else. Let's try that. Just hold on 1 second, Claire, okay? Okay. Okay, Claire, you're on the air.
I live in Manhattan. I am, you might say... heritage preservation is my bag right now, mainly because I believe, and I think this applies to language too, you have to know where you've been and where you are in order to have any idea where you're headed. But that's just an observation. The main things I object to, well, one is now, finally, dear Jim Lehrer has gotten it straightened out, is multiple use of the word troop instead of misusing it as singular.
Well, we've talked about this in the past.
Yeah. It seems
I don't
to come up
hear your show.
It seems to come up every couple of months, but the The usual meaning for troop, the accepted meaning, is a unit of soldiers.
Yes, but I think
rather than a single person.
Yeah.
Right, right.
But the main thing that has me climbing the walls is either seeing it written or spoken. A chaise lounge, which is, I think people may have thought that the term in French was misspelled and they changed it into lounge. I mean, what it is a chaise longue, and that means a long chair. And no way is it, can you lounge in one?
I'd actually like to defend that usage, though. I think it makes a lot of sense. We don't say chaise longue. The phrase came into English, and we've more or less made it our own by conflating the French long with our word lounge. And I think it makes some sense.
Well, do you also defend lingerie?
Yeah, I do. So we have our own pronunciation.
Not the bastardizing the spelling or what.
No, but we're.
I'm almost bilingual, and I grew up, you know, speaking French before English, and so it really rubs the wrong way. I guess that's the main problem with why I don't like it.
You probably say homage too.
I vary. I say homage, but the people, sometimes people like it. French grammar classes in high school, and they say, what's the rule for it? And I said, I can't tell you if there even is a rule. It just sounds right to me.
Well, you know, there are a lot of words that are legitimately English words, like niche, for instance. And let me talk about niche, N-I-C-H-E. It was a word in English generations ago, up until sometime in the 60s, I think. There was only one pronunciation for that word in English dictionaries, niche.
Now people say niche.
Now people say niche under the misapprehension that we ought to be saying it as though it were a French word. The same is true of homage, which has been in English for hundreds and hundreds of years. There's no reason to pronounce it as if it were a French word, homage.
Well, then we wind up with forte, now has become the standard pronunciation.
Exactly. We pronounce it as if it were an Italian word. It's not. It's an American word, fort, or English word, fort.
But how far do you go with this? Coup de grâce, some people say. Well, in French, that means something rather horrifying. A coup de grâce is a whole other thing. People think, I guess, that they're pronouncing it correctly, the French way. They drop the last letter. But shouldn't we stick to the original pronunciation if we can,
because
it makes more sense?
Well, there's room for difference of opinion here. But if you're deliberately throwing in a French expression into your conversation, naturally you want to pronounce it as if it were a French expression. If you're using a word as if it's part of the English language, which homage is, which niche is, and also the pronunciation niche now, as fort is, if you want to just use them as though they're English words, use them as though they're English words, as many of them have been for centuries. There's no reason to revert to a pronunciation that in some cases these words never had in English. Now, coup de grâce, that's a different, you know, that's a French expression. So I think you could justify speaking.
Otherwise it just explodes in your face.
Like a bomba. But I just think we should be reasonable here. And in the case of chaise lounge, I think enough people say chaise lounge, and the word lounge happens to be fortuitously like what we do in what this caller refers to as a chaise longue. We lounge in it. So I think we should let the language take its course.
But would you object to somebody saying chaise longue? Chaise longue? I don't know. Chaise
well,
long.
If somebody chaise put long. It in the middle of an English sentence, I would think he was being a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. Gosh,
and you
I
can
am
disagree.
So pretentious.
You can disagree if you like.
I'm a really pretentious guy. Dale, I think you're going to have the last word here, Dale.
Okay, finally, okay, here's a prepositional phrase fault that I find maddening, and it's, I'm not feeling up to par. Well, you don't want to feel up to par. You want to feel under par. You'd like, rather than a
Dale, now Dale.
If you say to people, under par?
Yeah, right. You're going to say, you know, I just don't think that's under par. People would be so confused, or they would think that you were making another kind of statement. It's up to par. That is the idiom, isn't it? It doesn't really matter if it makes golf sense.
I don't play golf, but when you're talking about the way you feel, and you want to use the golf image as a metaphor. Yeah, you aren't feeling up to whatever the par is.
Right.
Maybe it's good to play under par, but you want to feel up to it, I guess.
I think we should call Tiger Woods and ask him what he thinks about all of this. Meanwhile, people can reach you by email, if people who did not get through or people who are too shy to talk on the air, and there are some of those, by going to your website. They can go to mailbox@grammarphobia, GrammarPhobia.com. I spell it out because some people have problems spelling that word. Or you can just go to grammarphobia.com and click on Pat's blog to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners. Pat will be back next month. In fact, she'll be back the day before Thanksgiving. That's November 21st. And I look forward to seeing you.
Thank you very much.